From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The world is waiting. Tomorrow might bring a resolution to the war, or it might bring the start of a ground war. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the military's plans with James Adams, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. And we talk about the anxieties of people with loved ones in the military, with Alex Molnar, the founder of the Military Family Support Network. Also today, we meet Joseph Shabalala, the founder of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, the a cappella group from South Africa that became internationally famous after performing on Paul Simon's Graceland album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has demanded that Iraq begin a mass withdrawal from Kuwait by noon tomorrow or face an imminent ground war. The Bush administration delivered a list of terms for that withdrawal to Iraqi diplomats today. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater gave the details of the fierce ultimatum delivered by President Bush early Friday morning. Iraqi forces must be out of Kuwait City within 48 hours and complete the withdrawal within a week. But Fitzwater hedged on whether Iraq's refusal to comply would automatically trigger a ground war.
Well, we obviously are not going to telegraph in advance when we're going to start ground force actions. And we want to give Saddam Hussein the opportunity to take advantage of this withdrawal offer.
The president brushed aside recent diplomatic efforts by the Soviet Union to end the war. His announcement coincided with the announcement of yet another Soviet peace proposal that President Bush said is an improvement but still falls short of the goals of the United Nations resolutions. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Iraq's Revolutionary Command Council has denounced President Bush's ultimatum that Iraqi forces begin withdrawing from Kuwait in 24 hours. The ruling council called the president's demand shameful and said it was working to support the Soviet peace initiative. The council also denied that Iraq is setting fire to oil wells in Kuwait as part of a scorched earth policy. The council called for a committee of UN Security Council members who are not part of the anti-Iraq coalition to come inspect the degree of destruction in Kuwait and Iraq. The Soviet Union responded to President Bush's criticism today with a second, stricter ceasefire plan, which it says Iraq has agreed to. The BBC's Bridget Kendall reports from Moscow.
The new Soviet plan sets out tougher conditions for an Iraqi withdrawal than the earlier eight-point program, but it falls far short of the Washington ultimatum that a withdrawal must begin by Saturday noon. According to the new Soviet proposal, which Mr. Ignatenko said had already been conveyed to Baghdad, an Iraqi withdrawal would be conditional on a one-day ceasefire, and Iraq would have 21 days to pull its troops out of Kuwait. But the Soviet timetable does specify that Iraqi troops would have to be out of Kuwait City in 4 days, and there's no longer in the plan a demand for economic sanctions to be lifted once two-thirds of Iraqi troops were out. Nonetheless, both the ceasefire and a call to annul all UN resolutions penalizing Iraq once the troops had pulled out of Kuwait won't please the Americans. President Gorbachev said his spokesman had spent an hour and a half on the phone to President Bush this evening without apparently reaching agreement.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over 2 points today to close at 2,889.36. Advances led declines by a margin of 8-7 in heavy trading of 219 million shares. This is NPR. Television reports from Albania say that at least 4 people have been killed in a clash at a military academy in Tirana, the capital city. The victims were not identified, but they were believed to have died in a clash between anti-communist demonstrators and Stalinist hardliners. Earlier reports suggested that the fighting may have taken place between reformist army members and hardliners who were preparing a military coup. The fighting came as Albanian President Ramiz Alia announced the formation of a new government. The new prime minister is said to be a reform-minded Marxist, but no members of the opposition party have been named to his government. Jordan's King Hussein today praised Saddam Hussein's conditional offer to withdraw from Kuwait. NPR's John Burnett reports from Amman.
I'm full of optimism and hope at the developments at hand. I hope we are at the end of darkness and witnessing the breaking of a new dawn. This is how King Hussein reacted today to Iraq's announcement that it had agreed with Moscow's 8-point peace plan. The king, who has thrown his allegiance to Saddam in the Gulf War, called on President Bush to show statesmanship and consider the interests of people around the world. In a surprising comment, the Jordanian monarch suggested that any linkage between the Kuwait withdrawal and an Arab-Israeli settlement should be left out of the current peace process. Formerly, he supported such a linkage. The king's cheery response came before the White House announced that it would give Iraq until noon tomorrow to get out of Kuwait before a massive ground war started. I'm John Burnett in Amman.
A top Soviet general repeated assurances today that the military has no plans to overthrow the Soviet government. General Konstantin Kochetov told an audience at formal Army Day ceremonies that the armed forces are not preparing a military coup. Government opponents have charged that the army is joining with communist hardliners to stop the country's democratic reforms. Soviet President Gorbachev was in the Army Day audience today, but Kochetov didn't mention him by name. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paul Simon's album Graceland introduced the world to the singing of Ladysmith Black Mambazo. This a cappella group was already well known in their native South Africa. They sing both traditional Zulu music and original compositions. My guest Joseph Shabalala is the leader of the group. If you've ever seen them, he's the one wearing the microphone headset. When he was in his teens, Shabalala left his rural village to find work in the nearby city of Durban. It was there that he started singing in vocal groups with other men who had also left their homes to work in the mines and factories. Shabalala's groups used to perform in local music competitions and always win. They were eventually asked to retire from competition and give another group a chance. That's when they turned professional. Ladysmith Black Mambazo is on tour and performs tonight at International House in Philadelphia. Let's hear something from their latest album, Two Worlds, One Heart. Joseph Shabalala, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
You've traveled such a big distance in your life in terms of meeting different cultures and becoming known around the world. I'm interested in where you started, like where you lived when you were growing up, what kind of life you had, what kind of work.
Oh my God! Did. When you take my mind back like that, I was just on a farm, sitting in that hut, and then around that fire. Sitting on my mat, sitting down on the floor, wearing that called beshu, the tradition skin. I was a head boy.
You were?
Head boy, looking after cattle, looking after goats and sheep. Nobody knows that. It's unbelievable to see myself around, including Russia, Japan, New Zealand, Australia. Even my people, even my mother, sometimes she used to cry and said, now you follow your name, because my father gave me a very good name called Peggy Zizwe, which means save the nation. And my mother used to say, now you follow your name. It is something good. It's unbelievable.
When you were herding sheep, was it?
Yes, sheep, goats, and cattle.
Did you sing a lot then?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's where I feel that I have music, because at a time I just compose new song and sing. Even the my guys, the guys who were working together with them, they used to say, you have new things all the time. You sing new song. I said, no, it just comes itself spontaneously.
Would it be imposing to ask you to maybe sing the kind of song you'd sing back then when you were young?
Let me squeeze my mind back. I remember the song I used to sing for my cousin. Oh, my God. Oh, that song just... Oh, right. Mm. And the song says, Wagqitha umuzi ukhathazela ngokwaliwa indoda ngobulihatha. Wagqitha umuzi ukhathazela ngokwaliwa indoda ngobulihatha. It means, Khathazile is the name of the girl. I said that lady was so bad to reject a right man. She was so bad, she rejected a right man. And there was another song I used to, just to criticize my cousin. Wachubuzela, wachubuzela wapika pansi, njengo makoti. Umakoti lo wayebona abantu bemzini. Wachubuzela, wapika pansi. That is Zulu dance. I was criticizing my cousin because he was afraid of girls. I said, all the time when you see girls, you just look down like a bride. What's wrong with you? Yeah, he liked that song, but he said, oh yeah, you criticize me, but he liked the harmony.
I want to play something that one of your groups recorded in 1967.
Ooh.
And this is Uma Malo. Now, is this recording from one of the groups that you used to sing with at the contest?
No, that was the latest group, which I think it must be 1969, early 1969.
Oh, okay.
I remember that I just applied to radio with my first group, but we didn't go there and record until the group split, and then we record with the third group.
Okay.
Umamalo.
What does Umamalo mean?
Which means, this is my mother.
Let's hear it.
Umamalo lo wangkomela du, obege singaliwa.
Umamalo
ngangi ngangi ngalang.
Umamalo
ngangi ngalang. Amena wamsha.
Umamalo
ngangi ngangi ngalang.
Umamalo
ngangi ngalang.
Umamalo,
umama wankomela tus, internet senyalewa, zam tuma, zawendele nzanse batejini.
Umamalo,
ngangi, ngangi ngalanga.
Umamalo,
ngangi ngalanga, mina wamshe.
Umamalo,
ngangi, ngangi ngalanga.
Umamalo,
ngangi.
Joseph Shabalala is my guest, the founder of Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Joseph, when you listen back to that recording from the late 1960s, does it sound very different to you than what you're doing now?
It sounds like my voice was sharp at that time, but now I'm singing every day, and then my voice, I don't know, it's a little bit getting tired. Because now it sounds like very sharp, yes.
You're known around the world now, and that recognition came at the beginning as a result of the album that you recorded with Paul Simon, the Graceland record. How did he find you?
In fact, Paul Simon, before he left America, he heard about Black Mambazo.
Mm-hmm.
Because when he arrived in Johannesburg, he just named my name. He said, I want to see Joseph Shabalala, the leader of Ladysmith Black Mambazo. I know a little bit about Paul Simon, especially the what I call the show which they did in Central Park with Garfunkel.
All right.
That one was popular even in South Africa, talking about 500,000 people who was in there. Some other press says million of people who was in Central Park. And then I used to listen his record from my neighbor called Bridge Over Troubled Water. And then when I went to him, that was my first time to see him. And then he said to me, Joseph, I like to work together with the group. And I asked him what kind of working. I'm talking about music. I said, oh, if you talk about music to me, that's my life. It's okay, let's do it. But that day I was very hurry because we have a show, and then we talk with him not more than 5 minutes, and then I rush to the show. When I came to my group, I told my group that, guys, I was looking Paul Simon straight to his eyes, and I discovered that that man is sent by God to open the gates. I think now this is the time to spread our culture and its tradition. Even themselves, they believe what I say. It takes about, that was February, October. And then October, we got a telex from Paul Simon. He wrote that telex from New York. And he said, Black Bombazo, let us come together and practice and record together in London. He sent a damn. He was singing alone. And he was playing, an I think it's an organ. Homeless, homeless, we moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake. And he was imitating my brother. Grr, grr, she, she, grr. And we just laugh. And then he welcomed me to compose, put Zulu English. And then I composed the song. From the beginning, I begin in Zulu. Emaweni, we baba silale maweni. Baba sisize, siyahlupheka, we abanda, which means, Father, we sleep in the cliff. It is very cold in the cliff. Almighty, help us. And then I continue in English. Strong wind destroyed our homes. We come together in London. We practice only one day, and then we record. That was wonderful working with a musician. Paul Simon is a musician, pure musician.
Win we bow, slowly my win we bow,
slowly my win
we bow,
slowly my win we bow, slowly my win we bow, slowly my win
we bow,
slowly my win
we bow,
slowly my
win we bow,
slowly my win we bow.
Sing.
Homeless, homeless, moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake. Homeless, homeless, moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake. Homeless,
we are
homeless, the moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake.
We are
homeless,
homeless,
homeless, homeless.
We
moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake.
Homeless from Paul Simon's Graceland album, featuring Ladysmith Black Mambazo, the South African vocal group that was founded by my guest, Joseph Shabalala. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joseph Shabalala, founder of the South African vocal group Ladysmith Black Mambazo. What were your first impressions the first time you started singing in the United States with Paul Simon, and you're singing in a really different kind of context than you were used to? Mm. I don't even know if you had performed with white people in the audience before, had you?
Exactly. That was my first time singing for the large audience, those multitude of people in Holland, in that arena for 2 days. That was February. That was something new in my mind, even to sing for only white people. It was amazing when Paul Simon introduced Black Mambazo, and then they welcome us with their warm hands. At the middle of the song, when we were singing the song Nomatemba, which means hope, when we sang that song, at the middle of the song, the people were screaming and clapping hands. They encourage us. And then we discover that, oh, the music is universal language. It knows no boundaries. People have the blood. They caught this, the melody, the harmony. And then we feel at home.
play an example of the kind of singing that you're doing now. This is from your recent record. And this track that we're going to hear was produced by George Clinton, the funk star. And yeah. I think it's kind of interesting that a group like yours, which is much more rooted in South African tradition, should have teamed up with one of the fathers of funk, George Clinton. Why did you two come together?
In fact, I'm a person who like many different things, but I love the way George Clinton put together his music and those noise. And I said, these guys like Black Mambazo when they put their noise in the middle of the song. I said, no, we must come together and work together. And I first listened to his show in Los Angeles. And then after that, I talked to my manager and then we come together. And
do you have very different styles of working?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. We just put Zulu in that funk. Funk and Zulu.
Well, let's hear how it sounds. This is from the Ladysmith Black Mambazo record, Two Worlds, One Heart. This is the piece, Scatter the Fire. That's Ladysmith Black Mambazo and a track produced by funkster George Clinton. And listen, I should point out here that not only is it unusual for you to be doing this kind of rap funk kind of track, but you're an a cappella group. You're not even that used to recording with music, right?
Exactly, but there is many instruments at home, those who are just imitate that Zulu beat in their instrument, which is called umbakanga. And then we have something like instrument at home. I loved when George Clinton's son says, check this out, man.
And you say it too after him.
Yes, I say, you check this out.
So how do you like rap? I mean,
I like it very much. In fact, I like all beautiful music. But my favorite is gospel.
And on this record too, you sing something with the Winans, the American gospel group, African-American gospel group. Well, did you hear gospel music growing up? What kind of music did you sing in church?
No. When I grew up on the farm, I don't know nothing about church.
I know it's not presumptuous of me to be talking about church, but I know you're a minister now, which is why I'm thinking of church.
Yes, I repent. In fact, that was 1975, there was a dream came to me and said to me, I must stay away from food, fast for 4 days, don't eat. By doing that, I will defeat my enemy. I did that. I don't know who's my enemy.
I was going to ask you. You don't know either.
I don't know. I don't know who's my enemy. I did that. I stay away from food for 4 days. I didn't pray because I don't know nothing about praying. And then after that, two guys in the group were getting sick. I take them to the doctors, and then the doctors failed to heal them. And then there was a guy, a person from church. I don't know his, where does it come from, but he told me late that he came from church. He came to my house and prayed for those who were sick, and then they get healed. And I said, God is wonderful. Let me join the church and worship God. And then I dedicate myself to God. It was 1976 January, because that was just a calling in 1977, 1975 October. And I dedicate myself in 1976.
So
and I was baptized.
So you're a minister. Do you have a congregation?
Oh, yes.
You do?
Yes, yes, I have a congregation.
That you lead? You lead a congregation?
Yes, I lead a congregation in my, what I call, in Claremont, the township called Claremont.
How often are you there?
Oh, I have, but there are many, what I call, pastors under me who are still on the, what I call, in church.
Right.
I'm still preaching even around. I'm still preaching with my music.
I've always heard about you that you're not very political. Is that true?
Oh, yes, I'm not political. I'm a Christian man. Although I point some other things, which is, I just point good and bad things, especially how to be good to God, how to praise God, how to respect, how to forgive each other, which I think it covers everything. Like pointing those people who are homeless. It came to be homeless people, and it came to even those people who were, but they are homeless because of we are just visiting here in this world. Our home is in heaven. We are going to sing before God. We just remind the people their way.
I'm sure that the success you've had internationally has changed your life very much. Where do you live now when you're in South Africa, and how often are you at home?
Yes, I'm at home, but not on the farm. But my mother is still on the farm, and then I just built a very nice house for her, and I have a very nice house in Durban at that place called Claremont.
Should I ask you what Shabalala means?
Shabalala, it means when I'm with you here now, and then I just disappear. Where's Shabalala? Where's him? Where's him? It means Shabalala. He just disappeared.
Did someone, who gave you the name?
Oh, that is the, I don't know where that name come from. I don't know where does it come from. Yeah, it's a long time, long, long time. Maybe 100 years. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
Joseph Shabalala leads the South African vocal group Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Here's more from their latest album, Two Worlds, One Heart. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Township Jam.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As things stand now, in the next day, either Saddam Hussein will have surrendered, or his troops and ours will soon be locked in a ground war. Coming up, James Adams gives his view on what's going to happen. He's the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, and he's been reporting on the Pentagon throughout the war. Alex Molnar is hoping his son won't have to fight a ground war. Molnar is the co-founder of the Military Family Support Network. We'll talk about the anxieties of Americans who have loved ones in the Gulf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has told Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein that he must start pulling his forces out of Kuwait by noon tomorrow and complete the pullout in a week in order to avoid a ground war. Mr. Bush said that while he appreciated a Soviet effort to work out a peace plan with Iraq, the first version had conditions that were not acceptable. In Moscow, Soviet officials worked to modify their peace plan and presented a 6-point program agreed to by Iraqi leader Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. This plan includes an Iraqi pullout from Kuwait 21 days after a ceasefire and supervision of this pullout by the UN. In Washington, the State Department says that there will be no negotiations over U.S. terms for an Iraqi pullout from Kuwait. Barry Schwide reports from the State Department.
Despite a break in relations, Iraq keeps a handful of diplomats in Washington. The most senior among them, Khalid Shawayish, was summoned to the State Department, and in a brief talk with two top U.S. officials, he was given a list of the latest U.S. demands. Shawayish was told the U.S. expects a reply. He didn't express an opinion, saying only he would pass the message along to Baghdad. In registering the demands, President Bush counted Iraq's conditions for a pullout, which included a suspension of a worldwide economic blockade once 2/3 of the Iraqi troops have left Kuwait. Those are the conditions the Soviets called positive and President Bush called unacceptable. Even so, U.S. officials again praised the Soviets for their efforts and said the two superpowers shared the same goals. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Israel has praised President Bush's ultimatum to Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait. Patricia Golan reports that Israel insists that anything less than total military defeat of Iraq poses serious danger.
Political sources here have expressed satisfaction with the American position, but from the Israeli point of view, without the elimination of the Iraqi war machine, Israel is still threatened. Deputy Foreign Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it is not only Iraq's presence in Kuwait, but Iraq's war-making capacity that threatens the region in the future. That war machine, he said, must be dismantled. Netanyahu said the threat of an Iraqi chemical attack against Israel may actually increase in the sensitive hours and days ahead.
Our best assessment is that he has chemical warheads. We cannot at all rule out the possibility that he will use them in this end game, if we can call it that.
Iraq has fired 36 Scud missiles at Israel since the start of the war. So far, they've all carried conventional warheads. But Israel's chief of staff today warned Israelis against complacency. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 2 points to close at 2,889.36, volume 219 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 8-7. This is NPR News. According to U.S. military officials in Saudi Arabia, Iraq has set fire to 145 of Kuwait's 950 oil wells, resulting in a smoke cloud over 25% of the oil fields. According to an allied spokesman, at least 100 of these fires have been set over the last 24 hours, and the facilities attached to them are being destroyed. Officials say that one U.S. Marine has been killed and 5 other U.S. troops have been wounded by Iraqi gunfire in what is called an ongoing border fight. According to Pentagon officials, Iraq has launched Scud missiles from inside the city limits of Baghdad. NPR's Richard Harris has more on the story.
General Thomas Kelly said that 3 Scud missiles launched toward Saudi Arabia yesterday originated from Baghdad, and Kelly's explanation for the new launch site is simple.
We have been very careful not to strike civilian targets. The Iraqis know that, so now it appears that they're hiding their Scuds out among the civilian populace because we have not been attacking it. We have been more careful than any military force in the history of the world in trying not to hurt civilians. We know that. I will guarantee you that Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis know that too.
Pentagon officials went on record today saying that less than one attack out of every 10,000 has resulted in civilian damage. There is no independent confirmation of that figure. This is Richard Harris reporting.
U.S. military officials have acknowledged for the first time that U.S. forces have used napalm during the Persian Gulf War. The Pentagon, in a statement, said that napalm, a highly flammable substance used in flamethrowers and bombs, had been used recently for the purpose of setting off fires in oil-filled trenches that the Iraqis dug as barriers. India's parliament has called on allied forces to delay a ground war in the Persian Gulf. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The war in the Gulf has entered a critical phase. In the next 24 hours, there could be a ceasefire, or there could be a ground war. As defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, James Adams has been walking the halls of the Pentagon, trying to get insights into what is most likely to happen. I asked him if he thought there was conflict or tension between the White House and the military over what the next step should be.
No, I think that they're both of one mind in that they want to get Saddam Hussein and his forces out of Kuwait in the shortest time possible. So that's not a problem. I don't think there's any disagreement, but there is certainly a degree of tension today. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colin Powell, was, according to my sources in the Pentagon, in a pretty foul mood all day, in part reflecting the mood of his senior officers, who are all anxious to get on to the next phase. They have, after all, up to now, been allowed to prosecute the war pretty much as they felt was best. And now, just when they get to the most difficult part of the operation, the most complicated and the most sensitive, they are just about teetering on the brink, just about to go in, and then they're held back by their coattails by the politicians. So there's certainly some tension in what is an extremely nerve-wracking time.
Do you think that if the noon deadline passes without further commitment from Iraq to leave Kuwait, that the ground war will inevitably begin?
Yes, I do, because we cannot allow ourselves, and President Bush has from the outset been determined that he would not allow himself to be trapped into a long and drawn-out negotiating process, which is the timing and terms of which are dictated by Saddam Hussein. But if he accepts that route, then we could find ourselves locked into several months of fruitless negotiation, which we cannot afford, either politically, militarily, or economically.
Do you think that Saddam Hussein has kind of timed his willingness to talk about withdrawal to the beginning of the ground war? In other words, do you think his timing is to prevent the ground war from starting?
Oh, definitely. He's a very smart operator, and he has not done this just out of the blue. He's done it because he wants, as he has always done from the outset, to buy time and to create a situation where he can make offers that he produces appear attractive to try and drive wedges in the coalition to win political kudos among his allies, and to be able to go out with something that he can say is a victory. And that's why the President Bush has been very clear that he, Saddam Hussein, has to say, I am withdrawing and I accept the United Nations resolutions, to take away any sense of victory, which is, of course, why one would think it unlikely that Saddam Hussein will accept the president's terms, because they rub his face in the dirt and they don't give him the victory he wants.
From your sources in the military, do you get a sense if the high command of the military really wants to fight this ground war, or if they'd be relieved and happy if there was a quick resolution that made the ground war unnecessary?
I think you, when dealing with the military, you look at this on two levels. One, there is the, if you like, the gung-ho factor of, well, we're there and we'd like to go and see what happens, and it's a sort of macho courage, bravery, training, or everything all rolled up into one. But then you go to a different level, which is the more thoughtful level, where any military commander who has ever seen war does not want war, does not want to go into battle, realizes that he will lose friends, colleagues, will see carnage and death on an appalling level, particularly in this particular conflict. And there is no sensible, sane military commander that ever wants to go to war under those circumstances. And so I think they would all be slightly sort of schizophrenic about it, if you like, very pleased that you don't have to go to war, but in a sense disappointed that you don't get a chance to prove that you can do it. But the overall feeling would be one of relief.
My guest is James Adams, defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Adams, defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. I want to ask you something that I've heard a lot of people ask. I think it's become pretty clear that the United States government, and I suppose the British as well, really don't want to end this war until Saddam Hussein is out of power or has been just soundly defeated. A lot of people are asking the question, how come the CIA or other coalition intelligence hasn't tried to just target Saddam Hussein and off him, you know, assassinate him, instead of waging this destructive war?
Well, there are two reasons for that. First of all, you've got to have extremely good intelligence to be able to do that. Not just intelligence that says, well, we think he was in this bunker at such and such a time, but intelligence that's good enough so that when you launch your operation, whether it be a missile strike or a special forces operation or whatever it is, when you launch it, you know that by the time the attack hits at the other end, your man is still in the same place. Real-time intelligence, and that's extremely difficult to get. We found it very difficult to track him on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis. We've currently got special aircraft flying 24 hours a day over Baghdad, trying to do exactly that, and it is very difficult. He's a very smart guy, and he understands about security. So that's point one. Point two, even if you do have that kind of real-time intelligence, there is, and it may sound bizarre given the war that we're currently fighting, there is a hesitancy, indeed a legal prohibition on doing the kind of thing you're talking about, the assassination. And there is also a reluctance to do that among the military, certainly among the intelligence community, who have been very badly bruised by that kind of thing in the past 25 years or so. So there is that sort of reluctance to overcome. It couldn't happen without the president's approval. You would then be operating outside the UN mandate by killing a head of a foreign government. And that's a very, very legally difficult area to go in. And I don't think anyone actually wants to particularly get involved in that. If he's killed by chance, well, fine. Nobody has a problem with that because no one signed up to it and it just kind of happened. And no one will shed any tears. But no one's going to sign a document saying, let's go knock him off, because that's really going a bit too far.
How do you think Saddam is looking right now as a military commander?
As a military commander, he's a buffoon because he has not managed... has never managed to fight his forces as a military commander. When he was prosecuting the war against Iran, he by and large left it to his military people. When he put his own hand on the tiller, it went wrong. He seems to have no clear understanding of modern warfare. His tactics or his strategy in Kuwait has been as close to lunatic as you can get, in digging in, putting in 250,000 troops stuck in the sand, making them sitting targets for our aircraft. I mean, no sane commander would have done that, who had any understanding of the sort of war that was about to be fought. Now, that's not to suggest at all that he's mad or that he's not a very smart guy, because he is. He just doesn't have the requisite military experience or the training to provide the kind of leadership that if you're a dictatorship as he is, you've got to give. Everyone looks to the leader to lead. Well, he is incapable of leading militarily because he doesn't have the experience, which is why this war so far has been much, much easier And there's been far fewer casualties on the Allied side than was expected because he's just not understood what's going on.
You always try to stay a step ahead of what's happening in a situation like this. What has surprised you, though, about the war so far?
I think there are two things that have been surprising. One is how much longer the air phase has taken than was originally expected. And two, how much smarter Saddam Hussein and his troops have been about with deception operations. They have been able to continue operating their Scuds, for example, which should have been destroyed in the first 48, 72 hours, for all this length of time, and are continuing to operate them. Now, that's shown, contrary to the sort of general strategy, a degree of tactical sophistication that has been very clever and has caught the Allies, I think, very much by surprise, and has been one of the reasons why the air phase has had to last so much longer, because we've devoted very substantial resources to trying to track the Scuds, and not that successfully. I mean, it's a thing that just takes a long time. And they've also used fake tanks and fake infrared signals and all that kind of thing in a very clever way, in the sort of way that we would do. And I think that's been quite a surprise.
Do you have in your mind a kind of best case and worst case scenario for how a ground war would play?
Well, the best case is that when we roll forward, they basically all come out with their hands in the air, and we take in the first 7 days, we're rolling so fast that we can't process the prisoners quickly enough, and the whole thing is over in a week, and we don't have any problems in Kuwait City, and there's a military coup, and Saddam Hussein is killed, and that's that. On the other hand, we could be in a position where we find right across in every area they are prepared to fight to the death, like, say, the Japanese were at Iwo Jima, and you end up with a very protracted, very bloody and difficult, drawn-out ground war, which not just includes the trench warfare at the front, but the battle for Kuwait City, and that would be very difficult indeed. As always, of course, in life, this we'll probably be somewhere in the middle. I think we'll get a high number of surrenders, but there will be pockets of heavy resistance, which will be difficult for us to deal with. But we would hopefully fight so that we don't have to close, so there won't be the hand-to-hand, bayonet-to-bayonet sort of combat, but we will stand off and use our capability of range and distance firepower from tanks and artillery and indeed even handheld equipment by the ground forces to just wear them down. But it still could be difficult. But I think it'll be that sort of in the middle there, where there'll be a lot of people surrendering because they've had terrible privation and appalling casualties over quite a long period of time and must be exhausted. But there'll still be some who will want to fight to the death. And so it's not going to be easy.
What's your political reading? Do you think there's any chance for a settlement between now and tomorrow?
Well, one always hesitates to say anything with politics is concerned, but I would have thought it unlikely because I cannot see that the Iraqis can capitulate in the way that we are demanding, provided President Bush is able to hold the Allied line to the very consistent, there will be no ceasefire until there's been a withdrawal, and Saddam Hussein must agree to implement UN resolutions and so on. Provided that is held, Saddam Hussein will not give up, and we will have to go in and we'll have to take Kuwait.
You think the requirements that the coalition forces have made for a resolution, that Saddam Hussein would never accept that now?
Well, put it slightly differently, I don't believe that we can possibly accept a situation where, as with the Soviet proposal, where we can be in it where Saddam can say, I will withdraw two-thirds of my troops, leaving 200,000 of them in Kuwait, and we can then abandon sanctions and we all go back to business as usual, and I promise I'll get my troops out later. This is a man who is known to be a smart game player, to be a master of deception, and we would then find ourselves in a position where in a month's time, after he's got his troops out, the weather is too hot for us to fight, and we are then having to wait until next winter before we can go into Kuwait to remove the rump of his forces. That is clearly completely unacceptable. So we have to make demands that fit in with our timetable, not with his. And that means acting immediately, not next month, not next in the next 6 weeks, but now. And that means he's got to give up right now. And I don't have any sense that he sees he's in that position. I think he still sees he's going to salvage victory out of defeat.
James Adams, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Adams is defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and author of the book Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel. Coming up next on All Things Considered from National Public Radio, we'll be looking over the two sets of terms that were issued today in Washington and in Moscow, the terms for ending the war against Iraq. Marlon Fitzwater, the White House spokesman, set out the conditions that Iraq has to meet for the war to end. And then the spokesman for Mikhail Gorbachev, Vitaly Ignatenko, released the conditions that he says Iraq is now willing to make. Well, the two sets of lists don't coincide. There are big differences, and we'll be exploring them. Also, news of the fighting in the Gulf today, and a report from Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas, about the families of servicemen who've been sent to the Gulf, and also about the rear guard there. That's next on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The whole world would feel the effects of a ground war in the Gulf, but the emotional impact would hit hardest on the families of the soldiers who would fight it. My guest Alex Molnar has a son in the Gulf. Molnar started a support network for military families because of the response he received to an open letter he wrote to George Bush that was published in the New York Times. In the letter, Molnar questioned whether this war was worth his son's life or the life of any American soldier. Right now, families don't know whether they're facing a ceasefire or a ground war. I asked Molnar if families are waiting on pins and needles.
Well, of course they are. I mean, our Oakland chair, Carol Shepard, her son is sitting just several miles from the Kuwaiti border in a Bradley fighting vehicle, so you can imagine how she might feel. This morning, my son was able to get a hold of me and said, well, I wanted to get a hold of you, Dad, because I didn't want you to worry. You know, the Scud missiles that were aimed at our base were shot down by the Patriots. So all of us are continually living with the concern that people we love very much may be killed or that we may never hear from them again.
What are your hopes and fears about the next 24 hours?
I've always hoped that the world would be able to respond to what was a clear act of aggression with a forceful evocation of collective security. We seem to be on the verge of doing that. And my fear now is the same fear that I've had since August, that the President of the United States has relentlessly constructed an American response to this crisis, which almost guarantees that we're going to be involved in a war against Iraq with high American casualties. So I'm hoping very much that that can be avoided. I am fearful that President Bush has set a dynamic in motion which will inevitably lead to thousands of our sons and daughters coming home dead or horribly wounded.
Can I ask where your son is and what kind of work he's doing in the military?
Well, I can't tell you exactly where he is
because
officially
right.
He's not there. I can only tell you that he's on the ground in the Persian Gulf and that he's obviously in an area where Scud missiles are a factor.
What kinds of calls or comments have you been getting about from families about the possible ground war?
Well, the families who talk call us are families who are very concerned about the high rate of casualties that have been projected. You know, people are very disturbed about political leaders who talk about light and moderate or acceptable levels of casualties. When a coffin comes home to a person's family with the remains of somebody that they love very dearly, that's as heavy as any casualty toll ever gets. So when people talk about only 12 Marines being killed or only 4 American from the 101st Airborne Division, only so-and-so many soldiers being killed, it's a terribly heartless and cruel thing to do. It's something that's said by our political leaders, and it's something that's said by people in the media. Those are very heavy casualties for the families that are affected by them.
Are you getting comments about wanting more information, or, you know, I figure families always want to know more than they can.
Oh, I think one of the horrifying things for many families is the information they get from their loved ones is at variance with what the public seems to be told in the media. I mean, the media is good enough to say underneath the press reports that they've been cleared by the U.S. military or allied forces or some such euphemism. In fact, what it means is this report has been censored by the U.S. military. And I've It's not uncommon for me to hear from parents who say, my son writes and says that they still don't have enough to eat, and please keep sending food because there isn't enough food here. We have reports from people who say, I have a loved one who's in the medical corps, and they are staggered by their lack of supplies and are really concerned that if it comes to a ground war, that those poor casualties are going to not receive adequate care. These kinds of things are very common.
And the mail doesn't get censored with those comments in it?
Well, apparently not. I can only assume that the volume of mail is such that it's impossible to censor it all. We've also heard from families that have said they've received empty envelopes that have been opened. So I really can't account for it. I can only tell you what I'm hearing.
What words of comfort would you have now for people with loved ones in the Gulf who are wondering what tomorrow will bring?
I can only say that the American people love the men and women who have been sent into the desert. Regardless of our party affiliation, regardless of our station in life, regardless of anything else, those men and women and their lives matter. And whatever else a person may be doing, I think now is the time to bend every effort to show our love and concern for those soldiers in any way in which we can express it.
Alex Molnar, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Alex Molnar is a professor of education at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and the founder of the Military Families Support Network. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Naomi Person, Pat Ford, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with production assistance from Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tuohy. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Syrian-born writer Rana Kobani about being a Muslim living in the West. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.